Hey everybody, I'm Jerry Webster. I'm an alcoholic. And when he asked me, what step are you on? I did say, you know, I'll be finishing up 4 and starting 5. And I don't know if I told you this, but I don't finish up exactly on a step. I kind of wander in between them a little bit and go back and forth and all that. Last week, I want to mention something that bothered me a little bit. I could put my finger on what it was. And I noticed there were some kids here, and it's great. I think it's wonderful. In fact, I barely noticed that there were kids here because they were so well behaved. But I was looking at my own behavior and maybe some of the things that I said and how I said them, and I hope I didn't offend anybody by the way I put things once in a while. And also, I will kind of let you know ahead of time that we're talking about steps 4, right? And it says resentments and fear and sex. Okay, so a little advance warning. We'll probably talk a little bit about sex now that I have your attention when we get started. And I'll try to keep it acceptable. I don't know. There's some, you know, it kind of reminds me of the story of Mark Twain. He used to cuss a lot, and his wife would really get on him about the cussing. And he just couldn't break that habit for anything. And finally, one day he let loose a string of cussing, and his wife repeated exactly what he said, word for word for word, as soon as he got finished. And he looked at her, and he said, "Honey," he says, "you got the words, but you just ain't got the tune," you know? And there's some ways that you can say something that it just doesn't have the tune, and I'll try and keep it fairly decent tonight. We're talking about step 4 last night, and one of the things I mentioned is, each one of these steps naturally, I think, leads into the next step. We talk about being powerless over alcohol, or hopeless, as I like to put it. And that's not my original word. That's something from the big book. It's from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in the 12 and 12, where it describes our condition repeatedly as hopeless. I think this is a wonderful program. I do a lot of reflection on a program. And when I talk about it, you notice I don't read a whole lot from the book. I'm not doing that to slight the book. I'm presuming that you all have the big book and the 12 and 12 and that you can read those things. I think it's very important because it helped me get a good understanding of it. But I didn't get this program of recovery from a book. Okay? I got it from another guy who lived it and showed me how to live it. And my sponsor had me going to a step meeting every Monday night for 1 year. In fact, he suggested strongly that I go to a meeting a night. All right. He didn't tell me when to quit doing that. You know, about 3 years later, I'm starting, how long do I have to go to a meeting every night? He said, well, how often did you drink, Jerry? You know, every night. Well, what are you going to do with all this free time that you're going to have when you're not drinking? That made sense to me. So I went for a meeting a night every year just about, and for the first year. And every Monday night, he had me going to a step meeting. And I got to hear 4 different people give the steps. And the first time I heard somebody give the steps, it was like, oh, that's how you do the steps. And then the second time I heard somebody do the steps, I said, now wait a minute, now I'm confused. I thought the other way was. And about the third time I heard somebody give the steps, I started thinking, what am I missing? And about the fourth time, I finally figured out the steps are the same. The steps are the same. The application in an individual's life is different. And I mention that because the application of the steps in my life is the only experience I can share with you. Okay, it may not be the same as your experience. I think the steps are the same. And I think doing them, we need to do them. And we need to do them with the help of a sponsor. I don't suggest anybody try and sponsor themselves. I'll tell a little story. I have a delightful young man that I work with. And he is another one of those walk and talk and miracles. And he's a real joy. But I made a suggestion to him. You ever do that? One of your pigeons? You make a suggestion to him? And my suggestion was to get started on working the steps. He was seeing another fellow professionally, and the other guy was kind of following up in aftercare on it. And he had asked him, you know, what is your sponsor suggesting and so forth. And he said, well, my sponsor suggests that I do the steps. And he said, well, where are you? And, well, I hadn't really started on number 4 yet, like my sponsor suggested. And he says, well, Jerry's liable to fire you. I've never fired a pigeon in my life, okay? But he came back and he told me about it. And I said, no, I just go back and tell so-and-so that I've never fired a pigeon. I just let them sponsor themselves, okay? and they have an idiot for a pigeon or for a sponsor, you know. And basically, I'm not trying to say that to slight the individual, because that's, I had to be told that also, because I would try to do my own thinking, and when I was depending upon what was between this year and this year to get me sober, I was in deep trouble. I was in deep, deep trouble. I remember one time, my two favorite phrases to my sponsor was "yeah, but" and "if only." And he used to tell me, he says, two phrases I never, ever want to hear you say again, Jerry, are "yeah, but" and "if only." And I said, "yeah, but Ed," you know, I mean, and he would jump down my throat, because he said, everything that comes after "but" is an excuse. It's an alibi. It negates everything that went before it. And what you got to do, Jerry, is you got to get rid of your alibi system. Your alibi system is going to kill you. And he was right. You know, I look back on it and I could see that he was right. Well, one time I says, I think, and he's, no, you're not ready for that yet, Jerry. You let me do it, you know. And I said, on the wall, it says, think. He says, that's for me. That's not for you yet. You know, you just, you, when you get ready to do think, and then you can do it. And, you know, he was right, because it was my thinking that got me in the position that I was in. And when I depend upon my own head and my own thinking, I used the phrase the other day, the most dangerous 6 inches in the world is right between this year and this year. And Dave knows the other most dangerous 6 inches in the world, but that is the most dangerous 6 inches in the world, okay? And it gets me in trouble, and, but anyway, that's what happens. And see, that's the nature of my disease also, all right? Because the insanity of the alcoholism that we're talking about, and the insanity of the powerlessness that we're talking about in step two, is not the crazy things that we do when we're drinking. I mean, normies do crazy things when they're drinking. Amateur night? You know what amateur night is, don't you? New Year's Eve, when then all the normies go out there and they try to act like us and they just flub it up terribly. They don't even know how to drive correctly. I mean, a drunk knows, you weave, put one hand, you know, and the lines don't weave. And normies say, I can't, you know, they can't do that stuff. But, where was I? Oh, I mean, they can do stupid things. They can act crazy when they get drunk, which is very rarely. And when they act crazy, they'll say, I won't do that again, and they won't, okay? But alcoholics, we just don't just talk to ourselves. We get into arguments with ourselves and lose the argument, you know. I'll never do that again, you know, and your mind is waiting over here and says, just you wait and see, you know, and before the day's over, you're doing the same thing all over again. So the insanity for us is not the crazy things we do when we're drinking. It's picking up the first drink of the next series when we're start rating sober, okay? After we've sworn off and we've had a little bit of time, you know, 3 days, you know, God, a long time. We've had a little bit of time, but we haven't, and we're not under the influence of the alcohol because it's not in our system, and then we say, this time it'll be different, knowing that the consequences are going to be the same. I mean, we should know that, but I never think of the consequences, you know. Did you ever have the alcohol call you? You know what I mean? I one of the times that I tried to tell my wife that I was quitting drinking, I told her I was quitting drinking. This is the time that I was kind of relapsing and in and out of AA. And what I was doing, really, I was quitting letting her see me drink, okay? And it was about the same time that I told her that I was quitting drinking that I suddenly took up woodworking in my garage, okay? Well, you know what was in the garage. I mean, it was just stored in all these little places. And there could be something going on in the household, you know? I mean, we could get in an argument or whatever, and sometimes I think I started them so I'd have an excuse. And I could. It was just like I could... Jerry, I'm here. You don't have to put up with this. You know, I'm waiting. I'll make you feel better. And I go out in the garage and do woodworking. It's a wonder I got all my fingers. It's just absolutely amazing. But I had been sober 2 years. We had moved down to Jacksonville, and we had a lot of stuff in storage. And after 2 years, we cleaned out our garage. And here we're unpacking these boxes that were in storage, and I'm finding a quarter of a bottle of scotch and a half a bottle of bourbon. I mean, stuff that I had hidden away and forgotten where it was, you know, from years before then. It's absolutely amazing. But anyway, step one is the basis for all the other steps. If we really are hopeless, we really are powerless, then we better hope that there's something bigger than us. And I believe that that higher power, to me today, is God, okay? The higher power of my understanding is God. And I believe he works through people. And I'm not trying to force any concept of religion, but I heard something one time that made sense to me. That the master, when he walked this earth 2,000 years ago, it was interesting the kind of people he picked. He picked fishermen, okay? And you wonder, why in the world did he pick fishermen? Well, if he had picked kings, then people would have said it was because of their royalty and their prestige and all that. And if he picked wise men, then what happened later, they would have said it was because they were so smart. And if he picked wealthy men, then it would have said because they had so much money. If he picked wise men, and it would have said because they had so much wisdom. And if he picked emperors, he would say it's because they had so much power. But he picked fishermen. And I think maybe he picked fishermen so that people would know that it wasn't all these other things that got the results, that it had to be a higher power working through the fishermen. It had to be him working through them. Well, guess who he picked to get drunk sober? Yeah, because they had ministers and they had doctors and they had hospitals and all kinds of things long before 1935. But who did he pick to help us out? He picked drunks. You know, and when you look at it, that has to be a higher power working through people. It has to be a higher power working through you people. To have this many people, can you imagine this many drunks sitting in a room if you're all drinking? I mean, this place would just be an absolute shambles. It would be a disaster. Yeah. Get off, I want to speak out. You know, people be fighting, you know, beating each other over the head for the and all that. So if we come to realize that there is a higher power, then the most natural thing in the world is to turn our will and our lives over to it. If I don't have the answer, somebody else does, and maybe I ought to follow their suggestions. And that's a decision that we talk about in step three. So we get to step four, and then we start making this list. Now the difficulty is, not only is the problem centered in my thinking, is that the way I look at my problem is centered in my thinking, okay? And we begin to list, we take a moral inventory, and we need to do that. I don't know how you all work, but when Ed said my alibi system had to come down, he was absolutely right. And in some ways, there's a lot of structures, unofficial structures, that keep my alibi system going. Anybody married to an Al-Anon, you know, But my poor bride in pre-Al-Anon days did what they call enabling. I mean, she almost loved me to death. All right? And you think about what was happening. If I didn't get up in the morning to go to work, she would get me up in the morning. And the longer I drank, the earlier she would get up. Because she knew she'd have to start earlier to get me up and get me out the door. And she'd start off with a cup of coffee in the morning, you know, come on, honey, you got to get... And help me in the shower. And finally, if I didn't make it one Monday morning, guess who would call the boss? Okay? Oh, Jerry's in terrible shape. I'm sorry, he can't make it. He's got the flu again. He's got the flu. Or his mother died. Well, his mother died last month. Well, she's a tough old buzzard. She died again this month. Right? I mean, all that kind of. And she'd make these excuses and make these alibis. You know what she was doing? She was responsible that I keep my job. She was saying, I am responsible that he keeps his job. A couple times that I got in trouble and with the law, and we had some neighbors that were attorneys, and she would go get one of them and get me out of trouble. What was she doing? She was saying, I am responsible that Jerry doesn't go to jail. All right? She would take over the checkbook. You know, I thought, and we ended up having two separate checkbooks. You know, I thought as long as there's checks in there, must be money in there someplace. But she would take over the checkbook. And we had two separate checkbooks. One was hers for paying the bills. And she knew that she had to get her money earlier in the month. Because if she didn't, there was no telling, you know, what was going to be left to pay the bills. So she was saying, I am responsible that the house payment gets made, that the power payment gets made, that this is done, that there's food in the house. And she kept accepting this responsibility. She even accepted responsibility for how my kids felt about me. Oh, leave Daddy alone right now. You know, he's not feeling good. And neither one of us knew how true that was. You know, he's sick. Neither one of us knew how true that was. But she would make excuses for how I was so that my kids would love me. Okay, trying to get the kids to love me. She was accepting responsibility for other people's reactions to me. The relatives, you know, we would plan a trip down to Miami to visit her parents, and I would blow it. I mean, there would be no way that she would get me in a car to try and take me down to Miami at Thanksgiving. So she would call her mother and say, I'm sorry, you know, something just came up and we just can't possibly make it. The car broke down. So she was accepting responsibility for what other people thought of me. All right? Guess what my reaction was? oh, okay, I don't have to be responsible to get to work. I didn't worry about whether I was going to get to work or not. She would worry about it. Oh, okay, I don't have to worry about being in jail because she wouldn't let it happen. Oh, okay, I don't have to worry about what other people think of me because she would take care of it. She was the barrier. She was the buffer. And while she was accepting all this responsibility, she's saying, I'm responsible for him, you know, for his life, for his job, for his everything, for him. And what happened is she kind of lost herself in that process. Because while she was assuming all this responsibility for him, in effect, what was happening is she was losing responsibility. She was saying, I'm not responsible for my own feelings and my own reactions to life. And she began to feel more and more and more like a puppet on a string, and somebody else was jerking her strings and her reactions and what was going on with her. Okay? And what happened is she's falling apart, and I'm staying sick. And the bottom line was, it didn't work. It didn't work. All that effort, all that work that she put into it, it didn't work. Well, instinctively, at one point, and I don't know if I'm going to tell you about this time or not, but instinctively one time she asked me, I'm not going to say she asked me to leave. It was more of a demand, and she was calling the police on the phone at the time to make sure that I got the message. And all of a sudden, we were separated for about 8 months. Guess what happened in those 8 months? It took 6 months for Jerry to reach a bottom. Because now, nobody else was responsible for me keeping the job. And if I goofed up, I didn't keep a job. I went through jobs like people go through underwear. Okay? Now, nobody else was responsible for what people think about me. All right? I mean, if I offended somebody, if I made a fool out of myself, there was no barrier. There was no explanation in between. It was just me and them. Now, I was responsible if I got in trouble with the law for little things. You know, like shooting up motel rooms with flare guns. You know, nobody could kind of call them up and say, well, it was all this big mistake, all right? And all those barriers and all those buffers were removed, and all of a sudden, oops, I got to be responsible, okay? I didn't want to be responsible, but it was kind of foisted upon me anyway. And what happened was that helped me to reach my bottom. Later on, she got into Al-Anon, and she began to accept some responsibility for her feelings. Regardless of what I was doing, she began to recognize. Well, you know, the reason I'm going into this a little bit is a lot of step four is recognizing the responsibility that we have in our own lives for what's happening to us. And it lists resentments. I don't know how you all were. It says resentments is the number one killer. I don't know how you all were, but I'll tell you what. I got to be an expert at building up a resentment. Okay? Because what was that? It was the blame and it was the reason why. It was somebody else's responsibility for what was happening to me. And I mentioned this, that this was there long before I started drinking. These characteristics, when I look back and I began to list these things, were there long before I picked up the drink. I mentioned this gal named Patty Witt in grade school and how she kind of, you know, I was afraid of the dark and I told a lie to get out of her thinking I was afraid of the dark because I'm afraid of what people think of me, see, you know. Kid 8 years old. I don't want people to know I'm afraid of the dark. I look back on it now, and if my kid's 8 years old afraid of the dark, I think, well, of course, you know, they're supposed to be. It's that age. And I don't think it's a big deal, but it was a big deal then. Well, what did I do? I made up a lie, and then when I got caught, rather than admit it, I would blame her, you know. And from fourth grade to eighth grade, I tortured that poor girl. I mean, throw snowballs at her with rocks in it, and just, I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff, you know. I tried to make amends to her once, but I guess she's married and moved away and probably grateful, you know. But I never could find her. But if I ever do run into Patty Whip, you know, not in here, is she? Okay. Somebody just got up and left. You know, oh, no, it's him. Okay. I'm going to make sure. But that was there long before. When my boss gave me, I'm not going to say he fired me, but after 11 years of that job, when I took the Japanese businessmen to the biker bar in North Charlotte, and we got chased out of there and ran my car into the woods the next day. And I was supposed to take him to lunch, and we went and bought our lunch at a watering hole, and then we drank our lunch, and then we drank our dinner, and we went on to evening entertainment. And I don't know what I was thinking, you know. I guess I thought they were going to turn to Samoa alcoholics, you know, that kind of thing, and they were going to take on these bikers. But we got chased out of there, And I wrecked the car running away from the bikers. I ran off I-85 in Charlotte into some woods and just tore up the right-hand side of the car. And of course, everybody on the right-hand side of the car got injured. I mean, the whole right-hand side of the car was wiped out. In fact, it was the same car I came down here with. I had the door tied on with a belt, yeah, because it was kind of dragging, trenching, you know, along the street when I pulled up into the driveway. And the boss said, "Where were you yesterday? I mean, you took the Japanese to lunch and never came back. And where are the Japanese, you know?" And I had to say, "Well, one's in stable condition over at this hospital, and one's been treated and released over at this hospital." You know, he's at the hotel resting up. And my boss said, "Jerry, we love you, but, man, you're too dangerous. We just can't keep you around anymore." 11 years with the company, worked my way up and drank my way down. But he didn't fire me because he didn't want to screw up my future. He gave me an opportunity to resign. You know what I got? I got a resentment against that guy. And I think I said some things that when I had to go back and make amends to him, I said some things to him that were not very nice, and I made some kind of comments about postal workers, and I understand what they do and why they do it. And, I mean, it kind of scary stuff, but that's where I was. And in my mind, I was justified in my mind. I look back on it, and I wonder why the guy put up with me for so long. But that's kind of what happens, the resentments. And what it talks about doing in the 12 and 12 and in the big book is making the list of resentments. And we start off with this list of people. And when I'm working with someone, I say the first thing you do when you're doing your four step, get a piece of paper, put the seat of the pants to the seat of the chair, put the tip of the pencil to the paper, and start writing your resentments. Who you're mad at. Go back over your whole life. Get that part down fast. And it's a long list of them, okay? And as I began to look through these things, you know what started to come out? And it tells you to do that in the big book and in 12 and 12. It says, we reviewed the list, we looked over the list. We began to find out more and more about ourselves. And I began to see a pattern, you know. Here I am, I'm at war with the whole world. And is it the whole world? Or maybe am I the one that's kind of screwed up? And as I began to see the pattern of my own behaviors, then I began to realize maybe I'm the one that's got the problem. Okay. It was so typical of me to blame somebody else. I think I mentioned that one of the first things I tried to do was make my kids love me. Okay. I was sober 2 months and my wife and children came back. God knows why they came back that soon, but they came back and they joined me down here. And I wanted to make the kids love me because now I'm sober and I deserve it. You know, hadn't done any steps, but now I deserve it. And I would try to make these guys love me because they would go in the bedroom and close the door when I got home. You know, what's wrong? Yeah. And these poor kids, you know, most kids learn how to act when they're growing up. They can act spontaneously. They can go up to daddy and give him a hug and jump on his leg and get a horsey back ride and all that. All my kids knew how to do. They didn't know how to act. All they knew how to do was react. Okay? What's he like today? Is it safe to run up and give him a hug, or do we kind of, you know, go in the bedroom and close the door? All they knew how to do was react. That didn't go away because Jerry put the plug in a jug. But I was going to make these kids love me, and I would take them to the ball game. And I said, "You will go to the ball game, and you will have a good time." You know, what's this guy going to do to me next? You know, and I couldn't understand why. And I complained to Ed, my sponsor. He said, "Leave the kid alone. Leave him alone. You know, you're working on the wrong guy." And then we finally convinced him to take him to a child psychologist over in Orange Park. And the guy was very incompetent because he sent the kids home and he kept me and the wife. All right. The kids were not the problem. So I got a psychologist and I got a sponsor both telling me the same thing. And so for the next 9 months, I started working on those steps and just left them alone. And I'll tell you what happened is, 9 months later, I came home one night and my wife says, "Jerry, Mike," that's my oldest one, "wants to talk to you." Well, my first reaction is, what did I do now? You know, what did I do wrong? And she says, "I think he's still awake." So I went in the bedroom and he was on the top bunk and I said, "Mike, Mom says you want to talk to me." He says, "Yeah, Dad." And I said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "No, nothing." He said, "You know, Mr. Johnson, our scoutmaster, is moving to Atlanta." I said, "Yeah, I heard." He says, "Well, Dad, he asked us if we knew of anybody that wanted to be a scoutmaster." And I was wondering, Dad, if you could be our scoutmaster. And see, the change happened. I mean, I just burst out, "Oh, I love to be a scoutmaster." Yeah. I mean, I guarantee you 9 months before then, the kid would not have wanted to spend a night in the woods with this drunk, you know. Can you imagine him in a tent with a flare gun? My God, you know. Don't let him start the fire, you know, whatever you have. But see, the change, I didn't make him change. What happened was I changed over a period of time, and I didn't recognize it was happening. But gradually, over a period of time, I was changing how I was acting. And guess what? Other people could then change how they reacted to me. Okay? And all this time, I'm trying to control. That's the other thing. I'm trying to control other people and what they do and how they feel and how they act. And, you know, they got to treat me right and so forth and so on. And it's backfiring. And now all of a sudden, I change how I act. And I get these wonderful rewards back. It's just amazing. It's just absolutely amazing. Meetings are a good example. You know, you get invited back. I couldn't believe that. Keep coming back. Who are you talking to me? You know, I mean, nobody's invited me back for a while, you know. It's wonderful. It talks about resentments. Besides resentments, let's see, what did I have to say? Besides resentments, it talks about fear. And a lot of the anger that I had, I think, was based in fear. When I go back and look at it, fear is kind of a secondary emotion. I think I mentioned that last week. And it says, list your fears. And we do the same things with our fears that we do with our resentments. We list them down on paper. By the way, I don't believe in not writing this stuff down. It says to write it down in a big book, and I think there's a reason to write it down. I'll tell you what. You ever do this? I can think anything, right? And it doesn't seem nuts, right? If I talk to my sponsor about it, as it's coming out my mouth and I hear it, I say, that sounds a little nuts, you know? And if I write it on paper and I look at it and I said, whoa, you know? And this is kind of the reaction I had to do in the fourth step. I'll tell you, I was so afraid my wife was going to, or somebody was going to find the fourth step. I speak Spanish, so I wrote it in Spanish, okay? And I was in Korea in the military, and I tried to learn Korean. I did learn the Korean alphabet. I wrote it in Spanish with a Korean alphabet, okay? And then, the worst parts, not everything, but the worst parts. And then I was afraid somebody who was raised in Korea that spoke Spanish would find it. So I locked it in the trunk of my car, you know? I mean, I was just. And, you know, I'm one of these guys, I didn't go out just embracing the steps. I had to be drugged by the short hair going through here, you know, and I'd procrastinate, you know what to do about procrastination, don't you? What I do about it, just wait, it'll go away. But I'd procrastinate, you know, put it off, and Ed would keep getting on me and, you know, and so forth and so on. I tell you, I learned to trust that guy. He was my first higher power, and the group was my first higher power, and I did learn to trust him, and I did learn to follow some instructions. Even when I didn't like what he said, because one thing that became very evident as he was doing this is he genuinely cared enough about me to tell me what I needed to hear and not what I wanted to hear. I remember one of the first things he did, he says, Jerry, he says, your first job is to get a job and don't get a traveling job. Okay, he had heard enough of my story where he decided not to get a traveling job. He said, don't get a traveling job. I said, why? That's where the money is. He knew what I was thinking. See, that's what my addiction was telling me. My addiction was saying, you need to make a lot of money, all right? But what my addiction really meant was, that's where the lights and the music and the tinkling glasses and the bimbo du jours and all that stuff is, okay? And I didn't realize that's what it was telling me. I said, that's where the money is. That's also where all your slips were, Jerry. For 1 year, I don't want you to take a traveling job. And I learned to trust this guy, and I did not take a traveling job for 1 year. Okay, guess what I did on day 366, right after I picked up my blue chip. Would you believe it? I went and I got a traveling job. And I thought, now I can make some decent money and catch up on these bills because we're way into debt. And I got out there and I realized I made a big mistake because I thought I was doing it for the money. And you know what? I was out there and I was lonesome and I didn't know people. And there was that, it was like, it was calling me again, you know, you don't have to do this, you don't have to be lonesome, you don't have to, and I started slacking off meetings, and I would come back in town about once a month, and after about 3 to 4 months, Ed saw me one day when I walked in one weekend at the San Marco Club, and he says, how are you, Jerry? I said, fine, I'm doing fine, you know, and he says, how are you really, you know, Do you like that when he does that? How are you really? I'm doing fine. Why? Yeah. And he says, Jerry, go in the bathroom, look in the mirror, and tell your face that, you know. And I almost did it. And I thought, well, wait a minute. What's wrong? He says, what's going on with you? And I said, nothing, Ed. I'm doing fine. He says, how many meetings are you getting to? Well, I'm not getting to as many as I used to. How many? Well, I get to the meetings when I come in town. So I'd be gone for a month, and I'd go to a meeting when I got in town. Yeah, I can get squirrely in a hurry after going to a meeting a day for a year. I mean, and he says, what's happening that you're not going to meetings out of town? And I said, well, I don't know. You know, those people aren't friendly like y'all are. You got to remember, I had been going to the San Marco Club for 1 year. And every day that I came back, those people said, oh, Jerry, we love you, you know, and good to see you and all that, because you all knew me. What time are you leaving? I said, well, the meeting's over at 9. I'll leave at 9. And he said, Jerry, you need to do 3 things, okay? First of all, you need to get the meeting a half an hour early. And then you need to stick out your hand to some people that'll talk to you, all right? And it might be somebody new doesn't want to talk. Stick out your hand to somebody that'll talk to you, and then stick around for at least a half an hour and invite yourself out for coffee or whatever with them. And he says, if you do those 3 things, I guarantee you, all those people will change. Wait a minute. You know, you've been telling me I can't change anybody else all this time. You tell me all these people will change. He says, trust me, Jerry, just do it. Well, I trusted him. So the next week I went back to Tallahassee and to Gadsden Street, and I had been there months before and didn't like it. So I thought, okay, I'll get there half an hour. So I got there half an hour early. The place was locked. Sit on the front steps. This isn't working already, you know. And this old guy comes up. He's got some keys, you know. He's kind of jingling. And I said, well, I'll get this over with in a hurry. And I stuck up my hand and said, hey, I'm Jerry. I'm a drunk. I'm from Jacksonville. He says, you're from Jacksonville? You know. And it turns out that this guy was the guru of the group. You know, one of these guys that sits in a rocking chair in the back, and they never call on him, but they always say the last 5 minutes, and these just pearls of wisdom just comes out of his mouth. He was the guru of the group. And he says, come on in. And everybody that walked in the door, he says, this is Jerry. Yeah, he's from Jacksonville. He knows so-and-so, and he knows so-and-so. And all of a sudden, I didn't have to invite myself out with him. They invited me. All those people changed, right? What changed? Okay, what changed? I wasn't giving them a chance to greet me because I was walking in there at 8 and leaving at 9. Okay, I had to change. Anyway, we list all these things. It talks about in step 5 also, step 4, that we talk about, besides fears, besides resentments, we talk about sex. Okay? It talks about where have we been selfish. And I'll tell you something. Alcoholics can kill love. And I think that this happens this way. The sex dies after the love dies. And then the people wonder why the sex isn't there. And, you know, you hear these stories. You know why Al-Anons close their eyes when making love? They hate to see a drunk having a good time. I mean, by the time we get done with them, you know, they're just... But, I'm sorry. Moving right along. But after a while, when the love, when we kill the love because of our behavior, I mean, the sex kind of hangs on for a while, but then it goes also. And then what does a typical alcoholic do? Selfish, self-centered in the extreme. If I can't get it here, okay, that type of thing. So we just aggravate the symptoms, we aggravate the behavior, all that type of thing. This illustrates what the problems with sex. You ever hear the story about these two drunks, and they're sitting in a bar, and it's getting close to the closing time, and one says, oh my God, I hate to go home. And the other fellow says, well, why? He says, I just know she's going to be awake, and she's going to be waiting for me. She's always waiting for me. He says, well, what do you do? He says, man, I try everything. I turn off the lights in the car when I'm coming down the road, and I turn off the engine, and I coast into the driveway, and close the door real quiet, you know, and take the chains out of my pockets, and tiptoe up the stairs, and open the door real quiet, and take off my shoes, and tiptoe up into the bedroom. And no matter what I do, she's always there, and she says, where have you been? And the other fellow says, well, you ought to try what I try. He says, well, what's that? He says, I come roaring into the driveway about 90 miles an hour, slam on the brakes, knock over a couple of trash cans, and bump the horn when I get out, slam the door, stomp up the stairs, throw open the doors, go stomping up the stairs, singing at the top of my lungs, walk up, slap her out of panty, and say, "Hey, baby, you want to fool around?" And she never wakes up. Okay, and it's all, you know. They get different kind of reactions to us after a while, us alcoholics, you know, and you really can't blame the Al-Anons, okay? It talks about, and you know, this disease of alcoholism, it's so pervasive. I never realized how pervasive it was. When I met my bride, I was drunk. When I proposed to her, I was drinking. When we got married, I was drinking. We went on the honeymoon, I was drinking. And I think I was drinking, you know, we got 5 kids. So I guess, you know, sex is important to me, or else, well, the other reason is I can't dance. But we have 5, yeah. We're Catholic, you know, and I can't dance because I don't have any rhythm. And when you're Catholic and you don't have any rhythm, you have a lot of kids. But anyway, I've got 5 kids. But, you know, we haven't had any kids since I've been sober. All right? I don't know what that means. I guess it means I know what I did in all my blackouts. Okay? It's kind of strange to wake up every 9 months and 20 minutes. Well, who was that? But anyway, it becomes such a part of our life, we don't even realize it. And when I quit drinking and my wife came back 2 months later, drinking had gotten to be like foreplay. I mean, it had become connected it so much in my mind that I had this problem when my wife came back with the plumbing, okay? And I didn't want to tell anybody about it, you know? And I said, finally, I went on for a couple of months, and I thought, I got to do something about this. And I went and talked to Ed, and I said, "Ed, I got to talk to you." And this was in a San Marco club, you know, I want to talk to him about this problem. And he says, "Yeah, Jerry, what's it about?" You know, it's going to the driveway, you know, in the parking lot. He says, "Oh, okay," you know. You get out there and people hanging around. "Yeah, what's the problem?" And I said, "No, let's go over here by the car, you know." And finally, I get over there and I tell him what the problem is. You know, and what does he do? He starts to laugh, okay? And I say, "Oh, but this is great," you know. But then he tells me why he's laughing. He says, "This is not unusual." And then he explained to me that it's been connected for so long that it's such a part of the way I live that I try to separate the two, and it didn't work anymore. And what he suggested was, start dating your wife again. Start dating. I mean, we're living in the same house. He says, "Yeah, take her home a rose, take her out to a movie, take her to dinner once in a while. Begin to date your wife. Begin to court her all over again. Because what you got to do, Jerry, is you got to learn how to do everything all over again. Because what did we do when we were drinking? Did everything when I was drinking, right? I had to learn how to do everything sober all over again. Yeah, try this. Everybody, you know, just fold your arms for a second. Everybody try that? Try folding your arms for a second. Okay? Feel okay? Is that all right? Okay. Now, fold them the other way." Yeah. Harvey's looking for instructions on the elbow there. How do you do this? Something as simple as that. You do one way your whole life and then you try to change it. It's difficult. So we make this list. We get done with all the lists. And the other thing he says to put down is put down the secrets. Put down the things that you feel guilty about. And I used to do a little experiment that I'll tell you with when I was doing treatment. I wouldn't do the fourth and fifth step with people in treatment, but I'd pass them each out a sheet of paper and I'd give them some instructions and I'd say, "This is a trust exercise. First thing I want you to do is put your name on the top of that piece of paper." And they'd, "Oh, okay," put the name on. I said, "Now, trust me. I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do with this piece of paper, but I want you to trust me. The next thing I'd like you to do is to write down the last thing you want anybody to know about you. The one thing you were going to take with you to your grave." So they would write down probably the second to the last thing they would want anybody to know about them, you know. Sometimes. I said, "Now, then I want you to fold it and I want you to pass it to me." And they'd pass it to me, put it in this box. And I'd unfold them and put them on my lap. I mean, you could just feel the tension going in the room. I say, "Now, we are going to do something with these papers. Are you all ready?" And you know. And then I'd say, "Let's everybody get up, we walk outside and we burn them." I never read them. And just the relief, I'm just, oh. I tell you, the reason I did that exercise was, I go back and I said, a lot of times people would say, "I don't really need to do a 4-step, I really don't need to do a 5-step, I was never that bad." I said, the measure of how anxiety you felt when you did that and the measure of your relief is an indication of how much you need to do the 4-step and the 5-step, okay? I don't know if that makes sense to you. But that was a tough exercise. The other thing is, we get done with a four-step. Searching, thorough, fearless. Write it down, review it several times. We begin to get some idea of the patterns. Then what they tell us to do is we find someone and go tell them. Go take it to them. Okay? Now, I don't know how about you all were, but I was raised Catholic, okay? And I had gone to confession when I was a mini monk, a monk's apprentice, about once every Saturday, all right? And I kind of kept that pattern up after they booted me out of the seminary for getting into the altar wine. And they told me they didn't think I was monk material. But as my drinking progressed and as time went on, I began to feel like, you know, if I'm going to get to heaven, I have to, you know, Saturday night I get the slate cleaned off. I was going to have to die somewhere in a two-hour slot between the time I went to confession on Saturday night and before I get the slate all messed up again. And I just, well, the odds were just against me. And I thought that's what the fifth step was. And it wasn't that at all. In fact, what has happened is that doing the fifth step has taught me more about what the exercise should have been when I was doing this before. It says in the big book, the best reasons first for doing the fifth step. The best reason first is, if we don't do it, we may never acquire lasting sobriety. Now that's a good reason. That is a good reason. And why do we need to do it with another human being? Getting back to this thing is, if I'm depending upon what's between this year and this year, I'm in deep trouble again. Okay? And if I just write this stuff down and just keep it, my honesty is all kind of, my humility, the level of my humility and my sincerity is questionable, let me put it that way. And I'm not getting feedback from anybody but the great moi, okay? And I'm probably in deep trouble. So I take it to another human being. There's a lot of benefits to doing that also. It says choose carefully the person you're gonna take this to. I had some things, I'm not going to get into it tonight, but I had some things on there that, you know, I was afraid to tell somebody some of this stuff, because my thought processes were, they won't like me anymore. I mean, if they find out what I'm really like, they won't want anything to do with me. The surprise of my life was, and I didn't know what I expected, but when I finally did share this, some of the stuff with my sponsor in a fifth step, the response was love. And the response was that he shared some things with me about himself that I didn't know, that he wouldn't talk about in an open meeting. Okay? And I didn't know what I expected. I guess I expected some kind of response like, oh, you are some kind of moral leper, unclean, get away, blah, you know, that type of thing. And it's not the way it was. It's not the way it was at all. But I was so afraid that I made an appointment with my sponsor to take my fifth step, and I didn't show up. And the next time I saw him, I says, oh, you wouldn't believe what happened. And I told him a lie about car trouble. And then I couldn't stand it, you know. I mean, you start to get a conscience back when you get sober. And then I had to call him up and say, hey, Ed, you know. He says, I knew. It's okay. It's okay. And I went to share with him, and he said, Jerry, if you're not comfortable, find someone else that you can share with. It doesn't have to be with me. And there was a couple things in there that I was really terrified to share with him. And what I did is I did my fifth step two ways. I did it with him, and most of it with him, and it was one or two things that I was holding back on, and I did it with a Catholic priest in a confessional. And I figured that if he told anybody, he'd go to hell, and it'd serve him right. Okay? Now, because he was bound by the seal of the confessional. And I did find a priest who was familiar with the AA program and knew what I was trying to do. And you know, once I got it out with him, you know what I did? I turned around and I went back to Ed. And I shared it with Ed. And a response was the same. The response was love. Okay? I mean, it was the most wonderful. That little red wagon I've been dragging around all my life with all that luggage in there and all that garbage in there. And I start to let go of it. And it was like a feeling of, just, I'm free, okay? And the one thing that I was afraid to do my whole life was to let somebody know me. And I finally let another human being know me. And it was okay. I mean, they didn't say unclean and, you know, send me off to leper colony and all kinds of stuff like that. They accepted me just the way I was. They were just absolutely amazing. Next week, we'll talk a little bit more about step five. I apologize for not, you know, kind of adhering to a format. But we'll talk a little bit more about step five. we'll get into 6 and 7. And I'd usually do 6 and 7 together, I really do, because I figure anybody can talk for an hour and humility doesn't have any anyway, so I try to combine 6 and 7 for an hour. Thank you for your patience tonight, and I enjoy talking with you.